baptism of John by the water and the baptism of Jesus by the Holy Spirit. The word baptism means initiation. It's the oriental term to initiate or to introduce you back to God. John was doing the ancient ritual of initiation and using water as an outward symbol for the five senses to reflect upon, and eventually when that individual had done his sufficient meditation, he could perceive that same physical sound of water as a vibratory nature of his own internal spirit moving within his body, and therefore he was hooked up back to the internal sun currents and go back to God. So we can see that John was teaching initiation by the ritualistic method. And he did not find a disciple in which he could bring down more power or perceive in a disciple worthy enough for the power beyond what he was offering in the form of a ritual. It is until Jesus came to him. Well, Jesus recognized in him that John was his guru, because it was Jesus who made the statement openly before everybody as he came to the Jordan River and said, "There is no man born of woman," and he was referring to them right there and then, "greater than John," and he singled out John, "who is Elijah," that is reincarnating now, "that has come." Those are his very words. And in view of this spiritual understanding, Jesus had to have the pre-awareness and the internal link with John in order to single him out and come to him and make this open declaration. We can see that Jesus knew what he was doing, and John, playing the humble role now, was not initiating from the highest order, but from the ritualistic order. That's why he said, Jesus said, "There is no man born of woman," and that was at the time in that particular area. "Greater than John," that is a soul that is embodied in the man's, John's body, that soul nature, was actually Elijah. It was the soul of Elijah, and it would take a realized man to recognize that. And it would take a disciple to recognize the teacher, because Jesus was the disciple of Elijah in a past life. Elijah had a disciple, and that disciple made a mistake or karma of asking the teacher for a double portion of the spirit, meaning, "Why don't you give me God realization?" That's what a double portion of the spirit is. A single portion of the spirit is self-realization. A double portion of the spirit is God realization. So John or Elijah at that time realized that the student was asking for God realization without working for it, by meditating for it. He wanted it bestowed upon him, because it was customary that when a guru would leave the body, out of 1,000 disciples or 10 disciples, one would be given the grace to be God realized. A God realized man cannot carry his God realization with him. He has to give it over as a birthright. He has to give it over to his spiritual son, or the inheritor of the lineage of that spiritual order. And Jesus merely jumped the gun by being overzealous, because you're afraid that you'll be left out. And this is a particular lineage. You will see a pattern of a great karmic pattern all the way back to time when the student is too zealous for gradualization. They usually jump the gun. So Elijah the Guru made a statement when he said, "Why don't you ask? If you see me before I go, the mantle is yours. Therefore, the student is asking for gradualization without working for it or earning it. He must pay a price for it. There is no something for nothing in the universe." And the Guru is very adamant about that by pointing it out. "If you see me before I go, it's yours." That poses a great problem on the student, because the Guru is capable of going into any level, physically, emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually. And the slightest quivering of the eye, if you are not aware, you would miss where the teacher has gone, and then he might leave the body in that particular realm, and then you are stuck there with the dead body sitting looking at you, and you didn't get the grace. So the student would have to be totally dependent now in all levels of consciousness, waking, sleeping, or meditating, totally involved. He couldn't go to the bathroom, he couldn't take his mind off of either of them. The moment his mind would drop down from that meditative state, the Guru could slip away. This was the imposition of gradualization. That is why you say, "Love the Lord thy God with all of your mind." You see, Jesus realized this when that imposition was forced upon him in that incarnation. All your mind, all your heart and soul. You couldn't get a greater test to achieve gradualization when you're in self-realization state than to have all of the mind now focused on God totally to the exclusion of the body. And the Guru then would merge with you, and you will merge with the Guru. That's the merging aspect of this disciple with his master. So when Elijah decided to grow up the mantle, which is the gradualization now, the lineage, the transference of the power, the right to be Guru now, or the right to initiate as a Guru, was then placed upon his disciple. Then that disciple lived and performed many things in the name of the Guru. But because he jumped the gun, which is a karma, asked for something without working for it, which you have no right. We don't have the right to ask a master for gradualization. It's not our right to ask. It is the master's right to give. So, since he asked, he violated the rule. He must pay the karma. And the next turn, in order to be a guru now, he must come back and take up the role. But he hasn't lost the memory of his relationship with the master. The memory is never lost from incarnation to incarnation. So Elijah has to come back as John now, a simple man, teaching now initiation from the ritual level and not from the divine level of spirit. And the disciple must come now and find the guru and force this particular part of the spiritual life to come to the surface. So when Jesus came and saw John, he realized this was destiny. And he said to John, "Baptize me." In other words, "You have given me God realization in the past life, but now I am still accepting you as Guru. And I'm accepting again the role of initiation, of baptism. And that you are still the Guru, the role has never been changed. Though God realization has been given from you to me, you baptize me." But John says, "No, you baptize me." The reason why John said that, because he had already given up the role, and he made many statements to that. "I baptize by water, but there cometh one who will baptize with the Holy Spirit, and whose shoes I'm not even worthy to unlatch." That meaning, he has dropped him down from the role of being a world guru into just being guru for people who don't have any self-realization. But that doesn't make him any less in God realization himself. He is fully God realized, but his role is not to be guru to the world. His role is just to be guru to a few people. The disciple who has taken the responsibility from a previous life now to be guru to the world has to come. So he is laying the credentials and the necessary recognition for that student when he steps into that role. So it can be said that he was already proclaimed by someone at that time who had a divine awareness, and that this man would pick up the work and do it. So when Jesus said, "Baptize me," John says, "No, you baptize me." Then you figure these two men arguing who should throw water in each other's head, if that's what it really means. But it turns out that Jesus perseveres and makes John initiate him by telling it to him, "Suffer it to be so." In other words, endure it. The roles are reversed now. But this is the way of righteousness. In other words, there is no way that we as human beings can get back to God from a self-realization level to a God-realization level until we meet a living guru to meet us by grace. We have to be initiated. That's basically what it ends up to be. So he is making a precedent, laying a foundation for all time. This is the way of righteousness. This is the right law. There is no other law for God-realization. There's no other rules for it. There's no other requisite for it. But merely that we must come back to a living teacher and accept the discipline of the living teacher and the initiation of the living teacher. And then John initiates Jesus after he accepts the responsibility. And it's John who saw within the third eye that the Holy Spirit descend in the form of a dove with a white light, or the aura coming down, this halo light, and heard within the Sankaran, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased," which really means this soul now can go up to all eight levels without having any karma to account for, and that's what beloved Son means. Not he's not a single person. Let us say that Jesus is a single person of all the other human beings singled out to be a beloved Son. It simply means that any soul who traverses the eight levels without any karma accrued or waiting to be paid, if there is none, then he has access to up and down. He can go up and down. He can take you back now. He can, by virtue of his love, can lift the soul up that is in delusion, in self-realization, back to God-realization. He becomes a mediator, he becomes a bridge. In me you have an advocate with the Father. John could have done it too, but John was not empowered to do it for his disciples. He was only looking for one disciple, that's where he came for, that one disciple. And that was his role. He came back to find the one disciple and to give that power to that one disciple to continue on. Now when Jesus took over, and having proven himself as the soul that can go up into each realm without being blocked by the Lord of creation, then he comes down and now he takes up the mantle to initiate by the Holy Breath or Holy Spirit. Which means now, he hooks you to the Sankaran inside of your own brain without the use of water, literally by the laying of your hand, or giving you the holy name to which you can mentally tune in and listen to the divine currents inside, just like you have been playing on top of your head. No. But he goes to prove that he is truly realized by going up into the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. And there he encounters his own self. And there are only three trials one self encounters before going on into the service of mankind. First test is eating. Spiritual food is determined by physical food. spiritual life is determined by physical food. What you put in your body physically to nourish it will determine to what degree you can grow spiritually. So that's the very first test. All religions prove it. Every ceremony of the highest order in any religion is centered on food. The Holy Communion is centered on food. The Seder is centered on food. The Diwali and Prashad and all these things are all centered on food, because it is the only physical fact that links us to the Spirit. God is food Himself. And the purity of the food is indication of the purity of the Spirit. The second test is to destroy yourself. You don't have a right to destroy yourself. And that means we don't have a right to take life. We cannot violate the sixth commandment to support the first commandment. The sixth commandment says, thou shalt not kill. And the first commandment says, to love the Lord thy God, and have no other graven images before him. So if you kill an object to eat, to nourish your body, to worship God, then you're violating the sixth commandment to preserve the first commandment. This is a contradiction. You can't do that. So if you kill yourself to prove yourself that you love God, this is a violation too. You don't have a right to do this because you didn't give yourself life. You didn't make life. And everybody goes into what is called this particular death wish. A sort of a cop-out situation when things get rough. We want to die. We want to chuck it in. We want to commit suicide. So we say these terms in our minds over and over. But when we actually do it, then we have the realization. So we don't have a right. And the consciousness was saying that if you jump over the mountain or commit suicide, since you're a child of God, you're fully realized, this consciousness will not allow you to hurt yourself. You send angelic beings to catch you lest you hurt yourself. We don't test God. That's why God is not that type of a realization. So Jesus said, don't tempt the Lord. Meaning, we don't have a right to destroy ourselves in order to find out if God will give us grace to see if we live a second time under the conditions. The final test is, since you can't make a man commit suicide to prove there is a God, and you can't make him eat what he doesn't want to eat to defile his spirituality, the last thing you can do to him is offer him all the possessions of the world, which is attachment. Well, a realized man has already come a long way. He's passed the two most difficult tests. The third one would be no problem, because he comes to the realization you can't carry anything with you when you're dead anyhow. Realized men don't have anything in this world. They merely use them, but they don't own them. They don't attach themselves to them. That's why they say, this is not our kingdom. This is not our home. We are sort of spiritual tourists. We just merely pass through here, and thank God we could pass through without being held back. So, right away, Jesus says, get thee behind me, Satan. In other words, negative illusions of physical objects don't faze me no more. So get thee behind me, negativity or limitations of self. Limitation of self is attachment. Right away, he breaks the third real test of the soul. From then on, he is competent now within his own soul structure as a being to initiate or baptize by the Spirit, because with these three trials under control as a master now, he can march into the world of tyranny by any form of tyranny and face it without being carried away by it, and be an example of how to rise above it. So if you come to a group of people who are tyrannically governed by tyrants who push you into the ground to be slaves and threaten your life, and if you don't do a certain thing to please them, they wouldn't feed you. He has proven you don't live by food. So don't do what they ask you to do, because they threaten you with food. And don't sell yourself short, because they're going to feed you some lousy meat to make you do it. Stick to your rules, stick to your principles, and rise above it. Better to starve to death than not to violate the temple. Gandhi did it. he starved and rather violated his temple. The next thing is, he has overcome the death desire. He doesn't cop out, he faces death wherever it is, however it comes. So when under tyranny, people would want to avoid the stroke or the whippings for not complying. He showed them not to die under that. Face it. Rise above it. It's God's own intercession. And finally, don't crave the liberation in order to be a greater tyrant than the other guy. To take away the country and run it over and be greater than him, or to make it any better. Just simply release it. We are only facing parts of our existence to which we come into and go out. And it is up to God to glorify you. And in his own life, he lives through the Caesar period of great tyranny, great stress. And when he finally dies, he demonstrates what is the great maturity spirit, mastery over death, your last enemy. So we come into what is called now the true initiation of the spirit, poking you into the sankharas so that you can hear them inside of yourself and go back home. So that's the difference between initiation by water performed by John and initiation of spirit performed by Jesus. Jesus initiated by the spirit, that is to lock you into the sanctuary inside, and John maybe did the outward ritual. We are slowly coming to the realization that to worship God is not in the outer ceremony. It's not in outer ceremonies. Worshipping God is at the heart center of the electrical body, or spiritual body. This is the heart center. This is the heart center of the chemical body. And this is the heart center of the electrical body. So when the pure in heart means when the mind is emptied of the heart center of the electrical body, then it's possible to perceive the oneness of God. That's why they say the pure in heart sees God. The emptiness of the mind is the opportunity for the experience of oneness of spirit. Blessed are they who are pure in heart, for they shall see God. Meaning, happy are they, or blissed out are they, who have emptied their minds and experienced the oneness of spirit, for there is the kingdom of heaven. For in that particular moment of time, you are totally aligned with divine being. Your God realization is an assurity. It's not a loss. The total memory of your nature returns back to you. Then you can open your eyes and you turn out into the world of existence, of elusive existence, knowing it's merely an outward drama, a kind of a movie script that is written for you, the actor, to act. So whatever role you find yourself in is just a part in the big movie to please the auto presence of God, Mr. God. He is the big producer, the big director and everything.
When John the Baptist drew water, he was beheaded.
Yeah. Now, he knew that.
Well, was that the author of the Bernal Karma of disciples on another level, or
why?
You know, why did that happen?
Great men always bring down great karma. Remember this. Elijah was John. And if you look back in the time of Elijah, he did something that warranted his death that way. You remember the life of Elijah? Anybody read the story of Elijah? What he did to a certain woman?
I don't know.
There was a woman called Jezebel, that Elijah.
Oh, yeah.
What did he do to Jezebel? Think of your story and you'll see.
Hmm?
Right, and who you think? Who is Jezebel now? Go back into your Elijah story.
Yes.
So he was beheaded by a woman.
Does the same Jezebel claim his head this trip as John? Herod's wife was Jezebel, and he was John in this incarnation, and the karma had to be resolved. It is given back to him.
Even though he was a
God-realized man, he had no right to bring down that type of karma on the person. Even if the person's karma warranted it, it was not his right to bring it down. Many of those men were too overzealous in their God-given powers, and they lost sight. Remember, a lot of them were in their self-realized state before they went into their God-realized state, and they did a lot of things in their self-realized state that would warrant the feedback of the karma before they come to the realization and to atone for it. It's only the God-realized state that they see the error of their self-realized state with their psychic powers. That's why the Master says to us in simple words, when you're in the self-realized state, you can lose your soul. What a profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul. It's in the self-realized state you get these powers, and these powers will entrap you, and you'll get belligerent, so sometimes you have to overcome all the moralistic feedback, so you strike back at a person perhaps. And even though you know the karma, you can read the karma, you can read all their past life, and you want to bring it down because the person is belligerent. But in those days, people's life was very, very harsh, so he was a type of a person who wanted the karma to come back right away and face the person. So he brought it down. He even went as far as when the children taunted him to make the she-bear come up to the mountain and eat up their children. So he was doing it in the self-realized state. He wasn't doing it in the God-realized state. The God-realized state came later. Even so, when his own disciple asked for it, he was very, very cryptic about it. Because he earned it. Remember, he's the type of man that earned his spiritual development by long hours of meditation. And when he came back as John, you can see how very, very determined he was to carry through his Elijah nature. But he was not going to be pushed around or anything. He was really going to carry them out to heaven if he could. Repent! You know, he grabbed a hold of two of them, pulled them down into the water with him. He was that type of man. But we can see how karma works unless we can have the insight to see if we don't realize why he did that and why it was done back to him. It was not done back to him because he was God-realized. It was done back to him because in his self-realized state he pulled down these psychic forces on others who were less developed than him out of their belligerency against him and in their wayward wantonness, which he condemned. And he, knowing the truth, and was very, very bent on the truth, he was determined to clean up the country. He wanted to be the spiritual conscience of his nation, but he couldn't. Right. He didn't want to be rejected. You see, in a self-realized state, Yukteswar said, even there, you're liable to fall down. And he told Yogananda, if you see me slipping down from my state, come catch my head and put it up back. Yeah. Masters can slip back from the self-realized state, but not from the God-realized state. We've got a long way to go to globalization.
Yeah, he became God-realized after, but that made him all the more anxious to repay the account.
Right.
There was no way it could be mitigated.
Okay. And when Jesus came into his body, he was self-realized. He wasn't fully God-realized. It was after God, Jesus became God-realized.
Oh, I thought he got it when he was born.
No. He got it, but he didn't bring it to the surface. He didn't earn it. He had to work for it. He was given to him by grace. You know, it's like a man making you an honorary president. They don't make you the president. You got to go out and get those votes. You got to work for those votes. See what I mean? It's an honorary degree that was bestowed upon him to elevate him. But he still had to go and earn the knowledge, the acumen or skill to handle it. So you have to do it in the incarnation of Jesus and go through the karma. and working it out.
Donna, do you believe that Mr. Casey missed the people that Jesus was coming to him? He said he was not possible. He was an entirely different God. Do you believe those guys?
What did Casey say? What did Casey say about his that he would say he was?
He just came from nowhere and went back.
Yes, there are four ways to be born and there are four ways to die. One, you're born having no memory of your past life, which 90% of us do. Then born having memory of past life, just very few percentage have that. Then born by immaculate conception, that's very rare, but not impossible. And then direct materialization, 21 years of age. And when you die but and rot. Then you die and you don't rot. Then you die and you take away your body with you, nobody have anybody to account for but your coffin. Or you just stand up in front of everybody and change your whole body into light. These are the four ways you come, these are the four ways you go back. They represent the four basic forces. But there's a fifth way. That's reserved for God. Because there are five forces in the universe. Water, earth, air, fire, ether. The four are obvious to us because we live in the five senses of manifestation. The fifth birth and the fifth death can only be experienced in the world of non-manifestation. That's reserved for God, the pure spirit. That is why when Moses went up into the mountain and wanted to see God, he told him, no man can see me and live. That would be a different kind of a birth and a different kind of a death. So Moses had to go aside and let the spirit pass. That was the shadow of God. While in the world of manifestation, we can only have that type of an experience in that level. We have to leave the body to get the other experience of the other birth and the other death. But it can't be experienced in this realm.
Well,
right.
And overcome
the others from the other. And this is why he was resurrected. As I said, that's a third death. And his birth was immaculate conception, which is the third birth, you see. In the case of Enoch going up and being born, manifesting, this has been done before, you see. As 90% of us are born without memory of past life, and some are born with memory of past life, and immaculate conception, you have total memory of past life, you see, you don't lose that. And materializing and dematerializing in birth or death, you have total memory. But these are rarities of the soul, you see, all for the benefit of God.
Did the soul do this before they do their final check in or whatever?
Yes. You have to. There is no jumping from grade to grade in God. It's not like a school that says, oh, you've been very good, we're going to put you in a skip to a grade now that you because you're in second grade and put you in a fourth grade. Don't work that way in God. In God, you go according to your efforts.
According to your efforts?
In other words,
grace sometimes too,
it's grace. It's all grace, but it's the effort that you put in to make this grace come down. The effort to have devotion. See, the effort that you put in is devotion. And that devotion brings down grace. It warrants grace. God only can release grace according to your devotion. Let me put it another way. God made everything, including ourselves, and placed himself within us as love, the vibratory sound field. This love can be withheld by our willpower from expressing love to God around us in the totalness of life by our own willpower. We can withhold love. We cannot withhold anything else, because everything else provided for the body to survive except the love, which we can withhold by our own free will, which is our willpower. That's our choice to block it.
And you mean love for other people?
Or simply love for God as life. Other people is God in segments. And life is a totality of everything around us as love, which we must love back, that caused us to come into existence. That very love that makes us, makes everybody. And that very love that is released from us loves everybody and loves ourselves. That's why Jesus says, love the Lord thy God with all your mind, your heart and soul, and your neighbor as yourself. But you can't love your neighbor as yourself until you love God, which is yourself. And until you know yourself, it's not possible to love God either. And that to know yourself, you must first start to love God. So you see, you're caught in this process with love. And that's why God made it in such a way that the only thing you can deny him by your willpower is love. Being love, he can't force you to love him. Being love, he must extract love from you by love. And in order to extract love from you, you've got to give up your willpower. You see, it's a very tricky game. He gives you willpower to deny him love, and he can't force you to love him by permitting you to love him under pressure. He's got to allow you to love him by surrendering your will.
And
suffering is the sacrifice of loving him. So Jesus said, not my will, but thy will be done. It's in other words, I can't love you to allow you to put me on a cross. But nevertheless, it's your will that I die on the cross. It's your love that I am dying for. You alone is suffering, not me. You made the cross. You are in the cross. You are in the nails. You are in my body. The conflict is in my mind. Should I go through this rigmarole just to please you? All right, I'm going to go through it. It's you. Who is going through it? You going through it. You the rigmarole. In the end, Jesus surrenders his mind. No mind now. Go on to the thing. In other words, it's a self-acceptance of pure love without coercion.
And then after that, he became
right. And it's in that state, the no-mind condition becomes anesthetic to the body, because it's total acceptance. When it's anesthetic now, there is no feeling. It's not reacting, because it's total surrender. It's in this total surrender that the pain condition that was objecting, which is the resistance. Pain is only an electrical resistance generated by objection to a confrontation on the body. Now, if you don't have this confrontation going on in the mind, there's no objection, then pain is an acceptance, then pain is a pleasure. There's no feeling no more. So when this was nailing him, he wasn't feeling anymore because he had surrendered to the condition. The chemistry started to take over. If we had machines in those days to check it out, we'd have seen that the brain was going through that. I was hooked up to the machine in Chicago, and I was using my own brain to check out if I resist, what would happen, and they stick me with a needle in the fire. Every time I resist, the pain registered on the machine. When I didn't resist, and I said, okay, go ahead. Then the brain was begin to make a change in the chemistry, and there was no registration, there was no waves going. And afterward, you begin to realize that a man who meditates long enough and has come to the realization of internal deacceleration of the brain by acceptance of love. That's why we say love is the easiest way to God, but the hardest way to do it. It's the easiest way, but very hard to do, because there's too much suffering involved in it. We rather cop out, but we can't cop out, because when we do, we don't love no more. So we go ahead and we love in spite of the pain, and let God take care of the situation. We are at His mercy, but it's better to be at His mercy by love than to be at His mercy by hate. You see? So you realize in the end that the only worthwhile thing to live in this world is loving, and not to generate no more karma, not to generate any karmas. If you can avoid generating the karma or resistance to your environment, this love takes over and works.
you know, every personality in the service is not so easy to get right.
No, I agree.
When they bug you so badly about it, are you building up karma?
You wouldn't get them to come around you if they weren't in, you didn't do it to them. It's a law of magnetism. It's a law of magnetism. You see, we have three laws.
Now say that again. What's law of magnetism? If they're bugging you, how's that law?
You did it to them.
Yeah.
At some time previously, we have done it to them. We don't get what we didn't sow, see? And it's a law of magnetism.
I keep reading that when somebody...
If somebody clobbered me in the head, is I did it to them before. And how hard they hit me, that's how hard I hit them.
It wouldn't have been
it ends when you stop accepting it and loving it. It ends right there. If you just say, I accept... thank you Father, whatever is happening, thank you Father, you know that statement, that's a very good mantra, that's
right,
the best mantra.
Let's say, Heather, suppose a person affects a lot of people the same way, what kind of karma are they thinking of?
You're only getting back what you gave it to them at one time.
All right, well, they're being obnoxious.
All right, but you were at one time, you had to be at
one time.
But you were at one time, you were doing it.
Oh, I know that.
So, all right, thank God you did it and you recognize it, now they're doing it back to you. Instead of you have to go up and catch up with them.
Well, what are they doing to themselves by continuing to
be? Well, that's all right, it is their turn to give it out.
They're going to get it back to
you. You know, we all like to dish it out, we don't like to take it back.
Well, I
want to
get it straight
that
it's coming back.
Well, it's coming back.
My goodness.
She wants to be sure they get theirs.
They got theirs. In fact, you got to be thankful. It could be worse that it don't hit you in the head. That's all right. Sometimes they didn't know you were doing it to them, too. We did it to everybody. We can't plant tomatoes and get corn. There's no way possible. You aggravate somebody, you're going to be aggravated back. That's plain and simple. Who will plant tomato and get corn? All right, isn't that a wonderful miracle if you plant tomato and get corn? You call everybody and say, look, I planted tomato from this package of seed and I got corn. And everybody said, boy, that's a great miracle. Now, the next day you plant the corn and you get okra, you can't trust the corn no more. Because you'll never eat corn, you'll never eat tomato. Every time you plant it, you're getting something else. But you're going to eat what you want to plant. See? God is perfect. He made a perfect law. You get tomato for tomato, corn for corn. And if you aggravate somebody, expect aggravation back.
So
when we accept the truth...
Not old age, then, when you get...
When we accept the truth, we can live with it. We don't have to run from it. We are prepared for it. It's in the preparation. That's why Jesus said, be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. He was happy with his crown of thorns. You know, today I saw what a crown of thorns looked like. The actual plant that is called crown of thorns. And if you could be cheerful under those conditions, man, you're really cheerful. It looks like you think of a Chinese acupuncture or something. Get a crown of thorns in your head and you really look like a pincushion.
You're really getting stimulated.
Yeah, every part of your scalp is perforated.
Donald, is it true that the sternum is the altar of the body?
The what?
The altar.
The what?
The sternum.
No. The spine is the altar of the body, the whole spine. The temple is the body, and in the temple there is a segment where the lights are placed, or candles, and the holy book is placed on a point of reference for sacredness. And the human spine is that particular point in the human body. It has seven segments for the seven candles that you find on an altar. So you have your coccyx, your sacrum, your lumbar, your dorsal, your cervicals. And along that now you have your endocrine glands. Now the sacred part of that spine is considered where the wafer is kept, the wafer being the reproductive principle of wine and water. So in the sacrum of the spine, which is called the sacred area of the spine, this communion principle or conjuncting principle is kept. It's representation of the generative forces in the body. And the spine is the actual warehouse for all the karma or feedbacks of the DNAs and RNAs that are carried over in magnetic law of memory patterns. So there was a saint who used to call his body a donkey. Saint Francis used to say, "Brother Donkey." And a donkey is referred to a beast of burden strictly because it has a very strong back, stronger than any other creature that you know that has a backbone for carrying weight on its back. Now, man is like a donkey. He carries the burden of his karma in his spine. The greatest weight he can ever carry in his whole makeup is his karma that he's accumulated there, locked in the DNAs and RNAs that may transpire in millions of lives. You begin to see now why they say that man is a miniature universe and God is locked up in him already. Until then, we don't really, it's not one segment of the body, is the altar, the whole spine is the altar.
Going back to what you said before, if someone does a wrong to you and you truly love them and forgive them, can't you cancel out that karma?
Yes. That's why Jesus said you must forgive your fellow man 70 times 7. You see, forgiving them, there are two ways to forgive a person. Psychologically and physiologically. Most of the time we forgive people psychologically, very little physiologically. I may hurt you and you may say, "Oh, I forgive you, Adano." But every time I walk in the room, you see Adano, you get uptight in your tummy. That's not forgiving. You haven't turned it loose, you see. Therefore, the karma is coming back. You see, there's a feedback.
And when you react to that person, like you always did, you haven't gotten out of it.
Right. So it's not only psychological forgiveness, it's a biological forgiveness. Therefore, the biological forgiveness is to hold hands or release or shake. That's why Jesus said, "Walk the extra mile with your fellow man before sundown." And I was going your way out to break the impasse on the physical pattern. And the early churches knew this and they developed what is called confession. That it, and later on it became gestalt therapy. Meet the other person, act it out, live it out, try and break up the impasse between yourself and the person on a physical relation. Because it occurred physically first, you see, but it's carried over psychologically. And if you're only going to psychologically forgive it and not break it up physically, you will get the worst end of it.
What is the best way not to keep yelling, Tom? Bad
Tom. Love. It's a very simple word, but very hard to do. I'm not going to promise you it's easy. Anytime you hear somebody overcome karma, I'm always watching for sure, because I know it involves pain. You see, it's a painful process. There's nothing more. We say hate is painful. It's not as painful as love. The process of love is more painful than hate. At least you know when you hate somebody, you're entitled to be hateful. You're entitled to.
But when you hate somebody, it makes you sick all over. All
right, but then that's what you expect anyhow. When you love somebody and then it turns out to be painful, this is much more painful than the other one. So, love is painful, but love is therapeutic. Pain is painful, but not therapeutic. It's destructive. This is the difference between the two. They're both types of pain. They're both involving pain, but one has a beneficial result and the other a destructive result. So that's why Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Your will be done." These are all painful experiences, generated out of love. Now, if he was belligerent about the whole thing and there's a, I blast you all to thy kingdom come and let the thunder and lightning take you all up and leave me here standing. Well, he could have done that and nobody would be wrong. This is his prerogative, you see. Just as much as he can give life, he can take it, you know. We must realize that when a man has the power to restore a life back out of love, what more does he not have in the terms of hate? If he does want to be hateful. See, if he generates life back to a dead man out of love, and that love returns to be a bitter situation, now that very man can turn around and condemn him, or deny him, or reject him. It's love that brought that type of suffering, but he still got a love. If he became belligerent to say, okay, you I saved your life, drop down dead, you know. That's being belligerent. So what good is he? Did he do no good?
Now, for instance, there are people who are just as evil, murderers. I don't mean a murder of passion. I mean people who really murder, What causes that soul to do that? Now, I know the stories about the people having it coming, but you know, you told us to agree, and I know you understand that. But there are some souls that just seem to be pure evil.
No soul is evil.
No, I mean the person on this particular life. Do they choose that before they come?
Would you say that?
Or have they disintegrated to that point?
The answer is yes, no, maybe. It's all three. As in the case of Judas, didn't Jesus say, "Woe to the man who had betrayed me"? Better he had not been born. But then, without Judas, would Jesus be crucified? Would Jesus be Jesus?
Yeah, try. I wonder why I said.
The hero has to have a villain to contest to make the clock ticking. God is a very smart producer, you know. He can't make a movie without any hero and villain.
So, I agree with that.
Well, who, all right, of all the 12 disciples, who was loved the most? Andrew. Most people jump to that conclusion.
Andrew was loved the most.
Huh? Judas was the most loved man of all 12. He had to love Judas the most. The one who hurts the most is the one you have to love the most. The one you love the most, you don't love the most?
I'm not typing that one, too.
You see? If I love you, how much more can you love me but the equality of the love? But if I hurt you, you go all of your way to love me more. So Judas was the man who hurt him the most. And Jesus went all the way to love Judas much more than those who really loved him. And those who really loved him didn't really love him in the sense that he knew they were loving him, because they all denied him. He knew they would deny him. He knew one would betray him. But between betrayal and denial, who would he love the most? He would have to love the one that betrayed him.
The black sheep.
Right. It's like the man who was given $500 and the debt was wiped out, and the one who was given $30 or $50 in debt. The man who owed more got more out of it. The man who owed less got less. So equally true in the terms of hurting the creative intelligence by being on the negative side would demand more love to resolve it. So the love is released proportionately to the damage,
well, that's why they
or to the relationship.
That's why they say angels rejoice when there's one lost sheep.
Yeah, the masters always rejoice when they found one lost sheep, and that's why the one lost sheep that the prodigal son was loved the most, and the other son who stayed home, he got kind of a, what do you call it, peeved, because the father was going to kill the fatted calf and all those nice goodies. You know, we always get that type of state of mind.
How do you measure love?
We don't measure
you
love.
It's
proportionately released according to the anguish. How much anguish you can generate in the individual, that is how proportionately the love can be released to match it. Alright, you have children. Which one gives you the most aggravation?
I don't know which day it is. Sometimes they do that.
All right, then is your love restricted or is your love more expanded than the aggravated mode? Don't you wallop them, but you don't just...
I don't even know it's love.
If you wallop them, you still love him. And that's like God. Even though he clobber us with the karma on our head, he still loves us. He'll be the first one to pour down grace. If you turn and says, Father, forgive me. At the same time, alright, I forgive you, but go clean up the mess. That's the karma, you gotta live it out. But you don't live it out with belligerency or vehemence or vengeance. You're given an opportunity to clean up the mess. So your own self-awareness brings on the reconciliation within, brings on the therapy in you. We have done mistakes out of ignorance or out of deliberate willfulness. Well, God is not that type of a principle. Life is not that type of principle. Life is a principle that allows us to make self-corrections out of love. We want to do it out of love to correct it because it is only natural to do it back. It's a natural phenomenon to do something, to correct something that we've made a mistake from, out of ignorance or out of belligerency, to correct it. It's only normal that we will do it.
Oh my God, suppose out of selfishness, we keep on walking over other people. Now what is that called?
Walking over other people.
No, seriously.
I know, I'm serious.
When you retreat, when you repeat and you repeat and repeat. Is it ignorance on your part, or is it blindness on your part?
There are many ways to solve the problem. But look at it this way. First, Jesus was asked the question, how many times should a man forgive his fellow man or his brother? He says, but Peter says seven times. He asked him seven. He says, no, not seven. He says 70 times seven. Well, you work it out. That's 490 attempts. Has anyone ever actually hurt you to the extent that you have made the attempt to forgive them 490 times? No, you haven't gone 490 times, and I'm certain within 490 times it would change. 490 times, you know, you confront this person. They'd have to change because... Now, there's a movie actor by the name of Red Skelton. He has a motto or a method in which he works with people who hurts him or affects him. If this person in his company doesn't get along with him properly, he would sit down and write that person a letter. But he doesn't give the person the letter. He writes all the things that the person is doing wrong and that should what they should do right and what they should not do. He's not going to fire that person. But then he writes that letter. Then he takes that letter and he puts it in the trash can as in a sort of mailbox. It's in the trash can, he forgets it. Then he waits. And if that person doesn't change after a while and is still continuing their ways, he's not going to confront them. Even though the managers are all complaining, he go in again, he writes a second letter. And he does the same thing, throws it in the trash can. And he waits for a while, and if he sees no change. He says usually, after the second letter, there's a certain change. The person seems to change all of a sudden, don't know how, but the change. Rarely he has seen, though, where he had to write a third letter. And he writes the third letter, and he throws it in the trash can. And he doesn't see no change. Then he writes a fourth letter, and the fourth time, and if people come back and complain, he writes this letter, then he burns it. And then he buries it and puts a cross over it, like a little coffin. Then he said no, he said that person is dead in consciousness. There is no hope to help that person. God, it was only God can help that person now. As far as he's concerned, that person don't exist in his company. He in firing him, that person suddenly finds themselves wanting to quit the job and go. Coming and saying they are removing themselves. He seldom has to fire somebody. And he says that seldom ever happens. In his career, as having his own company at work with him, he says he's only had one such person. All the rest have changed between the two or three letters. And he has found that this method works. It is because he has set up in his own consciousness a relation pattern with his employees. If the person has done something to affect the harmony of others, he would do this and try to correct it without calling that person on the carpet and confronting them for having disrupted the harmony of the group. And it's an amazing thing. When the people learn of it that work in that company, they're very, very happy because they're all shareholders in that company. It's a profit sharing company.
Well, is he directing that they should change their ways and be better?
Yes, he's writing.
That was against our.
No, he's writing down. He's writing down what this person has done wrong. To such and such. The people complain. Said, "All right, Jane has hurt me, Mr. Skelton. All right, and he's done such and such to me." He's got all these complaints, so he writes them down. He makes a note, and he's writing a letter to Jane. "Dear Jane, such and such a person, you've done such and such a thing. All right, we understand you're not doing it." And he writes this letter in a nice way, and puts the whole thing and throws it in the garbage box. He doesn't show it to Jane.
No, but I was wondering if he was directing
her conscience. No, he's not directing his conscience. He just is a mental process. But he says in his own career, he's only had one person who have actually withdrawn from the company and gave no reason. He just said they were finding another job. They got better off. He didn't fire them. He figured that if they couldn't function in his company and be harmonious with, it was better that they go on to something that they can function better. So he considered that person dead. They didn't exist in his company as long as...
Even though they were there,
and suddenly he finds them still withdrawing. There was only one. Actually came to him and said they had an offer for a better contract, and maybe... He says, fine, go on. Because as far as he was concerned, he was dead in his contract. Or dead in his company. She was not employed. Though he was paying it, and she withdrew. In a way, this is a very fundamental law, and it's not magic to it. It's simply an acceptance of the law of forgiveness. It's a form of love which employs or generates a type of suffering at the expense of oneself. But at the same time, it's a therapeutic form of love because it brings back balance and harmony with those who are being hurt. Now, not only that, it opens a lot of spirituality among the group. They have realized what has happened. They have realized what they are feeling belligerent about or complaining about, and then they start to see that it was not all that person's fault too. It's some of that fault was theirs too. And he never said, "All right, I'm glad you're complaining to me and I'm going to praise you." No, he simply documented their complaints and they said it was legitimate to them. It was disturbing their harmony, their family. He didn't say it was right or wrong. He's the owner of the company. So all he's going to do is document this thing, make this notation in a legal letter, and envelope letter and put it in the garbage.
Well, actually what he's doing is everybody is releasing these animosities and resentments that they have. They're getting rid of them to them, but he's not keeping them.
Good.
He's writing them and throwing them away too. So everybody's getting released. Is
so it's a form of recycling of their behavioral patterns by emotional release in a documentary way.
It's sort of like letting off steam too. You know, when you're angry with things and just write it out and then throw it away. And then you get it out of the system.
It is a principle that works because thought is there, word is there, and deed is there. Of course, you think of it, that this person is hurting, and you talk about it, then the action of writing it to say, "Look, we know you've done it," but it's these laws that are working. You see, spiritual laws are scientific in their own frame of reference. Very, very scientific. They repeat themselves, they prove themselves, and that is what is upsetting, because it's a different frame of reality to the evidential type of science that wants everything under the sensory observation and to control it in its own rationalization. When you come into spirituality, there's nothing to rationalize, because spirituality is very irrational. It's always intuitive. And on that level, we tend to be very, very leery of it. And we can be speculative about it. But until we understand how it actually works and how the mechanics go on, then we can put ourselves in a frame of mind to flow with it. And before you know it, it is actually a science working in your life. It's a science of living.
Can you do that? Mm-hmm. Do we have to make him wear a bracelet?
Yes, you can do that, make him wear a bracelet.
Donna, you know, I've read so many times lately that dying, the aging and dying, is something we've built into our country.
Yeah, you see, because we're counting our birthdays
right.
In the opposite direction from 0 to 100. You see, I started off from a 10,000 back.
Oh, you did.
I'm going back this.
Well, now, was that built into the pattern before we came, though?
Oh, yes.
Just that we're here now rolling around in it.
Yeah, because that's the way we want to come, you see. We want to come that way. We don't want to go this way. You see, we stay, we came out from the year one, and the longer we're away from God, the older we are. That makes us spiritual antiques. But if we all came out from the year beingness, and we're returning back to the year beingness, then we're no old. Everybody is young. You see, I started out with zero, which is the year of beingness. And I'm returning back to the year of beingness, so I'm still a zero. If you have to put that into your consciousness, that you are eternally one with spirit. It's a sense of oneness, and you don't have no more counting. Counting is separateness. You see? Chronological counting is a form of separateness. You see, I'm chronologically 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, what it is. This is a form of separateness. Because you're linearly drawing the energy and limiting its flow. When the energy is like a figure eight, it has no start, no end. So, if you don't put the concept of age into your consciousness, then there is no aging.
How old is your finger?
Well, everybody should feel with their finger, that's how old you are. Don't you feel your fingers? Well, that's how old you really are. When you have lost the ability to feel texture by touch, that is the true oldness of your mechanism. You have lost the ability to feel texture, and that's how you're really aging now. Because people who, younger people feel with a lot of texture, they can feel texture much more than adults. And when you lose that ability to feel texture, then you're really aging. So when I say you're young as you feel or old as you feel, it's relating to textural touch. So don't lose the textural touch. Textural touch is an indication that the cells are alive. They are responding. Therefore, you're retaining your youthfulness in life. Alright, Babaji looks like a young boy of 21. But give and take, 1,000 years in bed for him. And I met a couple of young fellows not too long ago, a couple of years ago. Give and take, I say 100, they tell me he's 156. But he looks pretty young, this fella. He looks just like a fella of 35, and all his hair is gray. And the skin is smooth like a young man. His name is Bawa. He's from Ceylon. When he came into this country, the medical doctor, the U.S. Embassy wouldn't believe his age. But according to the evidence, the doctor put him down for 100 years. Well, he's a young boy of physiologically 21, but he's a chronologically 100, but he settled for 100. How are you gonna tell the embassy, you know? Physically, the examination says he's a young man. Has everything, every function that he's had. But chronologically, he's supposed to be that amount of years.
Is he God realized?
Yes.
Was Babaji born a woman?
He has a sister.
That's a funny way to answer it.
Who isn't born a woman?
Well, Melchizedek, I understand, wasn't born a woman.
Well, that's what they tell us. But then Divine Mother is a woman too. You see, we can't get out of the Mother Nature aspect. Mother Nature provides us the ability to come out of the cosmic womb by direct materialization. in this material part of the world of manifestation. Or we can come out of the womb immaculate, that is extrasensory insemination. Or we can come out of the womb of creation having total memory through the genetic process. Or come out through the womb having no memory. Melchizedek and a few other people have come into this worldly womb by that particular law of materialization. As I said, there are 5 births and 5 deaths. 4 are for this world of manifestation. The 5th one is reserved for God. He himself reserves the last one in the world of non-manifestation, because God borns unto himself, and therefore there is no death in God, but all birthing. Now, only in the world of manifestation we differentiate birthing from death, because death is a condition of cessation. Therefore, it's called an enemy to the life stream. And then you get the realization that there is no death, that it's all birthing. Then you take on this divine awareness in the non-manifestation. If you go into the other realm, you begin to see now for the first time that all is birthing and there is no death. The only real truth is the changing, changelessness of change. The changing, changelessness of change.
Yeah, that's...
And that is what is called eternal birthing.
Keeps on changing
God. You see, God is ever new joy. That's the eternalness of birthing. And that's the changelessness in its own self. And that's the change within its own changelessness. That is a change. And nothing can stop that. That will come, that's infinity. When we realize that, we can now function in the world of change. See, this is a world of change, but where it becomes changeless is because it's infinite. That means this change continues, and that will not change. You see, since it continues to change already, it's changeless. There's where its changelessness comes in, from the fact that it's changing in an infinite state, or in a continuous state. In other words, from the time they made the Model T to they made the new Thunderbird, it's a new model. That's another way of saying God is a new model. Life is always producing new models. But if you look at your Bible and you look at all the writings, they never say, I'm a God of the dead. Didn't they say, I'm the God of the quick and the living? The quick means people who move around, you know, and restless. Unchangeable. It didn't come to judge the dead, it come to judge the quick and the living. You know, you got to read the Bible more objective and begin to see that they're talking of living people, and they're talking of living experiences. You get the full focus of it, that is happening now.
In Exodus, you know, when he eliminated all those thou shalls and thou shalt not, he says to kill the witches. What exactly was he talking about? Just to kill the witch? What does he term a witch?
Who
would do that? Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's doing... Mm-hmm. I'm tired of some of the vowels and skipping.
No, I think you better go read the game.
It's 1:9, and it's in 22.
Remember those old fellas when they got caught up in their self-realization and their acidic abilities? They went rampant with it. They all got carried away with their spiritual power. That's why it's a profit of man to gain the whole world and lose his soul. Remember, none of the things that Jesus did with his spiritual powers destroyed. They elevated and relieved suffering with it. But every other saint or prophet that you read about, what did they do with their spiritual powers? Right. They abused it. And that's why Jesus confront. He can only confront something he himself did by a mistake in a previous life, and go look the story up between Elijah and the student and see what the student did after. Like teacher, like student. He did some pretty goofy things, like his guru. His guru called them a beard to eat up people's children, and he called them a lot of strange things when they were self-realized, and the student did some of that too. But the student came to the final realization, that's not the way. That's why Elijah says, in the form of John, I'm not even worried on that issue, because this is somebody now who has got a deeper understanding not to use his psychic powers with that belligerent or traumatic action. Love is greater. It isn't that an eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth is not a true law. It's the law of cause and effect, yes. But we don't have the right to bring down the law into the life of an individual who has hurt us, simply because they deserve that punishment for violating that law. We don't have the right. If we love them, the law itself will take care of them. Now, we have an example like that in the autobiography of a yogi. There was a swami who used to drink clabbered milk. And he was sitting down one day, and a boy came to him with a bucket of quicklime and said, "Hey, Swami, here's a bucket of clabbered milk. Would you drink it?" "Sure, drink it." 2 minutes after, the boy said, "Tap, Swami, I'm dying. I'm burning up. I'm dying." He says, "Kapha, don't you know your life and my life are one? That a quicklime would kill me, but God took care out of love. You got burned. All right, don't die now." He saved his life. But he didn't deliberately pull down upon him the karma, though he knew. You see, this is the difference between deliberately bringing the thing down on the person that says, "Ha, you're giving me quick karma, I'm going to punish you now, die back, you feel the pain." This is the belligerent attitude of it. This can happen in the self-realization state. The same thing is true in Jesus. He knew they're going to nail him on a cross. Was he going to stop it? No. He knew his own disciples were going to betray him. He doesn't stop it. Buddha knew that his cousins were going to feed him poison cake just to get the wealth of what has been accumulated, and he still doesn't stop it. He, instead of picking up the non-poisonous cake, and he knew which one, he knew long before which of the cousins were doing, he deliberately picked up the poison one and eat it to die in front of them. You see? Then that will pose a kind of a shock to all his disciples. He's the Buddha. Why didn't he know? Who could trust him now, you know? Their whole dream of the Buddha shattered. Krishna was the same. Krishna did so much, and yet somebody shot him with an arrow thinking he was a blue antelope. They saw him walking in the woods and only saw the feet of the thing walking and looked so blue they thought it was some wild deer, you know, you can catch it and hang it up for a skin. Turned out to be Krishna. But these men, all of them, Guru Nanak and all these men, they didn't know how they can die. They don't stop the karma. They don't even vengefully react anymore on the, because they've learned from their previous lives that in the self-realized state, we react with our spiritual powers to punish. We usurp the right of God there, and that's where our mistakes can come. We can lose our soul there and have to do the thing over again. So if we don't usurp that right and allow God to really bring on His law into motion, then we are God without.
What happens to a man who is a judge and he brings down certain penalties, just or unjust? Where does he sit then in the scheme of things?
The justice is set up by the decree of the people to which he must adhere to, and the penalties are drawn up. These penalties are set up. Now he is administering them, just like an accountant must administer that you pay the bills on time or else they're foreclosed. He can't be held belligerent or deliberately doing it. That's his function. In that state, he is absolved. But if he makes it a vindictive practice, a personal vendetta, to go out of his way to make these laws belligerent, then he is responsible. See, it's the spirit of the law, not so much the letter of the law. That's where a judge is in a very, very serious situation. He has to weigh everything. And therefore, he is in a position to grant clemency or mercy. just as much as a governor can grant clemency or mercy to a prisoner or pardon. These are all within their discretionary functions. But when it becomes vindictive, then you find that they are making it a personal issue, then their karma is become their personal karma now. But once the function of society has set up certain rules and regulations to govern its behavior, and then the lawyer or the judge or the person involved that must mete out this punishment, then that person is carrying out the function. You have to look at it another way too. There are certain discretions according to the seriousness of the conditions involved. You see, if you're going to carry the maximum penalty or the minimum penalty or the medium penalty. These are all circumstantial again. But only when the person becomes belligerent or personally vindictive in the issue, then he must pay that karma. The same is true of the man who orders his men to go into the army and to fight. The men are carrying out a certain order. That general has to carry the share of the burden of that command. But that is the position he has put himself in to warrant that. So that's his spiritual responsibility he has to work with. So sometimes it's not good to be the leader of anything. And yet at the same time, you never mature in order to discover your sense of responsibility and sense of judgment till you become a leader of something. So in both cases, it has advantages and disadvantages. It is the carryover from the olden days, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And this is again certain conditions that we've carried over in ourselves, and out of that we do maintain it. Now, we're going to run into a lot of problems to maintain it or to abolish it. Simply because we haven't evolved to where we are capable of lifting our consciousness up. Remember, what is once a sin became a crime under a new semantics in the world of society. And what became a crime finally found itself to be a disease in the world of therapy. And what has become a disease will find itself to be a miscalculated a miscalculated timing of the mechanism.
Everything that it comes.
Right. Eventually, when we come to the full truth, you will find that sin is actually miscalculated timing, which was once called a crime for society and is called a disease in terms of the human body to function properly. But it's miscalculated timing or improper input, therefore improper output. Programming is the actual thing in the final phasing or final understanding. Our behavior, be it uplifting or degrading, is the input-output principle. It's the timing game, that decision-making inside.
In other words, recycling is just a tune-up.
However you're programmed and however you're fed from the environment will make for the particular action. You can make criminals out of individuals by feeding them bad nutrition. You can make them saints by feeding them good nutrition. The input would have to do with it. You can make them criminals by programming them with wrong ideas. You can program them with good ideas, they can become spiritual. You can make them feel sick by bad colors around you, wrong color schemes. You can make them feel healthy with good color schemes. And the same, it's again the external, internal action.
Is one probably good for one person and bad for another?
Yes.
His own or
it has its own particular personality and corona and effect on the cells. And then you have a lot of things to consider, what the masters call karma. That's your prenatal causes that occur prior to birth. They have a lot to say no matter how you come out as an individual. What the mold was. You see, a product can only follow the mold to which the mold was. If there are cracks in the mold, or there are burrs in the mold, or there are wrong measurements in the mold, that will come up in the individual. These are shock patterns now. Yes, during the prenatal stages, when the mother and the father might have been in different shock states of 9 months, those shock states leave the impression that will create a disorder and a miscalculated behavior pattern, and therefore you have that type of an individual coming up. Now, we are a type of society, we would like to see everything, what you say, A1, okay, square. We don't want to see anything triangular or round. We detest anything triangular or round. We want to put it back A-OK squared. Simply because our minds function in the nature of organization being the most expedient economic way to exist. Chaos is not economic and it's not expedient, therefore that is triangular. It fights against itself. And if it's organized and centered, we can function better. All right, if we accept that, that's the input. But then we have to accept the consequences with it, that go with it. That we could be carried away with our AO, okay attitude, our square attitude, and be living in an ivory tower. That what is good for me is good for you, and not necessarily any worse, you see. So if we do end up being tyrannical or fanatical in an okay square environment. Everybody's okay, nobody's belligerent, nobody's, you know, everybody's square, you know. But simply because one body wants to make a, that can be, can create a type of fanatism too. And it can be tyrannical. Right. They end up that way, but you see, organization is to provide a service, and that's why leaders in the organization have to be flexible individuals. The gurus are flexible people. They only aid the organization to come into manifestation, and then they phase themselves out of it, providing an opportunity for individuals to discover their shortcomings. They don't try to be the organization. If they try to be the organization will bury them. They only provide an opportunity for the individuals to grow and see themselves. So they are the most flexible people, the most adaptable, therefore they're considered the most spiritual. When we become rigid and compartmentalized or segmentized, then we become tyrannical. We are like the dog in the manger, don't want the cow to eat the grass, simply because it's good for us to lie on. But we can't eat it. We end up being like that. Our own particular thoughts, our own particular ideas is always, anything outside of that doesn't concern. So we tend to shut ourselves out. All colors are good, and all colors can affect us negatively or neutral, depending upon the shock patterns in the body. For some people, some colors are ideal, for others they're not. And these are shock patterns. Well, it's when you wear it, if it gives you a nausea feeling or gives you elated feelings. Or if you come in contact with some, are very depressive. And they are only depressive by stimulating or bringing to the surface some painful memory that might be experienced in a shock wave pattern by the parent in a prenatal state or during the state when pain was inflicted on you in some form, those colors were obviously present then. Then it will leave that impression on you. and you in turn resent those colors afterwards. But if you can actually therapeutize your body by using all the colors, eventually you'll find it'll start phasing out the ones that you don't like. The body will start handling it. All colors will start flowing for you then. It'll work for you. There were certain colors I didn't like years ago. I simply had a reaction in the body to be nasty or feel upset. But I kept changing it gradually till every color became natural to the body. But you have to work with it. And when you work with colors, the particular problem that is bothering you seems to come to you in a dream form or in some image form, and you recognize it, where the particular irritation is coming from. It's to me, color in the future would be the most therapeutic, self-therapeutic approach to basic subconscious problems and shocks than any other method, without aggravating the system or getting into expensive therapies. It will bring to the surface quicker the incidences that are triggering it. They're both have their own values. You can't say one is more effective.
I have trouble believing that's necessary. If we pray for forgiveness, then a lot of that we change, you know, even if we're not aware of what we've done.
Everything works, and there are times for each thing to do its job. Sometimes prayer will work, sometimes a slap on the rectum will work. Sometimes a little recycling will work, sometimes a needle will work, sometimes a herb will work. In other words, anything can cure anything because anything can cause anything.
So it's just a matter of changing the pattern in one way or the other.
You see, Jesus, when he was alive, he used everything to correct the problem. And we're realizing today that practically anything can cause a problem in us. So really there is no actual one thing 100% catalog perfect is going to correct anything. Not true. Even the fact that you press on the person with your hand and do a certain reflexes, it doesn't correct everything. Just alone you wouldn't, all the food in the world couldn't correct. Or else there'd be a lot of people still alive around. They ain't. So there is a time for us to phase out. There's a time for us to use certain things to alleviate certain conditions. And there's a time for them to not alleviate. They just have to go through that particular period of anguish or agony to correct it. That period of anguish is therapeutic for them. Not all the anguish is therapeutic, but some is therapeutic.
You're coming up, before you said a group of were at a time, a time cycle, and yet there's a time for everything, so our getting out of cycle was still time?
It's time, yes. Outer cycle is time. That's what Carl Jung calls synchronicity. You've got to synchronize with your environment. And if you don't synchronize with it, you're out of time with it, and therefore you're going to feel hurt, you're going to feel upset. You're going to bring on more problems in yourself. If you synchronize with it and you flow in the time cycle with it, then you learn to pace your energy. You don't squander your energy. Now, they always ask the question, how come we work so hard and look so fresh? They work so little and look so tired. Where do you get your energy? I don't have any energy, because I don't own no energy. I only know one simple law, that energy is determined by my mechanism's ability to accept the flow of it according to its own time cycle. So I pace my body to the time cycle. I learn to relax the body to accept the time cycle, to allow the energy to flow without being interrupted. The body physically, if it's exhausted, that's out of time cycle. It will produce lactic acid. And the lactic acid will make the body dry up and burn. If I pace my body and I don't get uptight or tired or force myself into that strenuous state, then the body will start recycling as you start flushing its own cells. Then it will clean out the lactic acid. So it's a matter of adjustment. Meditation is a form of pacing your energy. It's a form of conservation of your energy.
So it's like you said about the car, you keep it 50 miles going up here and 50 miles coming down.
If you go up 50 miles up the hill and take your foot when you're going down, you save gas. But if you put your foot on the accelerator when you're going down, you're losing gas. You see? Again, it's a matter of conservation and pacing the energy. If you get into a particular action and then you're constantly burning the energy when you should be learning to pace it, then you're going to be tired before it's over. Yes, let us look at it more objectively in terms of valuable benefits to the body. If you can space your meditational practice into 20-minute periods 4 or 5 times a day, you'll benefit more. Or if you go a straight whole hour, once in the morning and once at night, and a half a day, an hour in the middle of the day, you get the same benefit. See? And the time will come when you can sit down for fully 2.5 hours and really sink into it. This is a way of arriving at what is called self-induced rigor mortis, or relaxation response of your cells, where you can actually maintain this inner peace. You see, the only place you're going to find inner peace 100% is in the morgue, you know, or in a burial ground where they put the sign on top, rest in peace. And then there's no better way to try to duplicate it in the body. Sleep is a good way, but that's a very slow roundabout way too. If you can get it in the meditational process without getting uptight, then you have induced it back in. It's a form of conservation of energy. See, the body has enough energy, atomically speaking, and this is physics, to last for thousands of years. We don't even live 50, 60, 70 years and it's all gone out of us. What has gone out of us is not the energy. What has really gone out of us is the desire to synchronize with life. And we have clogged up the mechanism with too much resistances, and therefore we exhaust the mechanism. We carbonize it and make it chug, chug, chug. It's like driving the car, you know, you turn on the engine, you don't change the gear, you sit down there all day and run the engine, what's going to happen? It carbonizes too much, and that's exactly what we do. We stay in an idle spot all the time and just keep functioning. We don't do any automations, then we carbonize, we over-carbonize ourselves. It's a mechanical thing. And then you turn around, you see a Model T, all renewed and done over. And it's chugging along beautifully. The human body is a better thing than the Model T. It stands to reason that we are not applying the techniques to remodel ourselves, or to conserve the energy in ourselves. Take benefit out of it. Well, I think we let you folks go home. let's join hands for a few minutes and